you very much, Lee. As I'm sure all of you are aware, on June 29th of this year, in Morrison versus Olson, the independent counsel case, the Supreme Court hit the doctrine of separation of powers about as hard as heavyweight champ Mike Tyson usually hits his opponents, or about as hard as the tree recently hit Mike Tyson. Until the Morrison decision, three principal doctrines protected presidential power from congressional pilfering. First, the Appointments Clause. Second, the president's removal authority. And third, the overarching doctrine that all executive power resides in the president and those answering to him. In a decision stunning for its vote, 7-1, its author, Chief Justice Rehnquist, and its breadth, the Morrison Court restricted the executive's constitutionally guaranteed appointment power, and more importantly, established that henceforth any alleged infringements on the president's removal power or on his executive authority in general would be judged by whether, in the court's subjective view at the time, the encroachment went too far. Justice Scalia, in a brilliant but very lonely dissent, wrote, "This is not analysis, it is ad hoc judgment." The topic of this morning's debate, of course, is whether Morrison was a knockout or whether it was merely a knockdown. Our two speakers are two old friends of the Federalist Society, under whose supervision I had the privilege and pleasure of serving in the Solicitor General's office. Charles Fried is, of course, the Solicitor General of the United States, who submitted a superb brief in a losing cause in the Morrison case. 2 years earlier, Mr. Fried argued and won a great separation of powers victory in Bowsher versus Sinar, which struck down a key provision of the Graham-Rudman-Hollings Deficit Reduction Act. And thus, in those two cases, some would say Mr. Fried succeeded in making the country safe both for budget deficits and for independent counsels. Paul Batour is the John Wilson Professor of Law at the University of Chicago, and for many years he taught at Harvard Law School. He served from 1983 to 1984 as Deputy Solicitor General and Counselor to the Solicitor General. During that time, in the Pawtucket, Rhode Island Kresh case and others, he assaulted the rigid wall of separation between church and state, and now with the same persuasive force he has turned his sights to a different wall, the wall separating the constitutional power of the three branches of government, leading some to believe that he may have been what Robert Frost had in mind when he wrote that something there is that doesn't like a wall. Mr. Fried tossed the coin before today's debate and told me he won, so he will go first. And after that, time permitting, there'll be an opportunity for a brief rebuttal by both speakers and then for some questions.
Thank you, Sam. It's a great pleasure to be here. I will state my interest. I am the man who lost Morrison against Olson. And you will forgive me if 2.5 months is not quite enough time to have persuaded me that I was wrong. What I'll try to do in a very dispassionate way is, rather than re-argue that, to indicate what the two different visions which were at stake in the Morrison case were, and which one of the two visions seems to have prevailed. And I might say a thing or two about whether that's a good thing or not. But really, what I'd like to offer to you is a picture of the choices that were there to be made, and we can leave it to the discussion to decide whether the right one or the one that's good for the country was in fact made. The vision of separation of powers, which we tried to offer and which I admit to subscribing to, is, I think, best articulated in the paragraph which Justice Scalia read from the bench as he delivered his dissent And it is from the Constitution, Massachusetts Constitution of 1780. In the government of this Commonwealth, the legislative department shall never exercise the executive and the judicial powers, or either of them. The executive shall never exercise the legislative and judicial powers, or either of them. The judicial shall never exercise the legislative and executive powers, or either of them, to the end it may be a government of laws and not of men. That is the great vision of separation of powers, which we sought to put before the court. Now, its constitutional basis is, I am frank to say, textual constitutional basis is brief, but I think powerful. There is no such ringing statement, as the Massachusetts Constitution states, in this document. What there is, however, and I consider it rather important, is the organization of the document itself and the fact that Articles 1, 2, and 3 begin with the phrase, the legislative power shall reside in, the executive power, the judicial power. And to my mind, that expresses an idea. And it's an idea which is, in fact, very close to the idea of federalism. That idea is that in this new nation, which was being constituted, there is to be no such thing as, there is no such thing as governmental power at large. And that itself was a revolutionary notion, because if you think of the nations of the world which preceded us, the assumption always was there is such a thing as sovereignty, there is such a thing as governmental power, and then there is the fight about who's going to have it, who's going to exercise it, and there are constitutions which will speak to it, but there is pre-existing any such fight, a plenum of sovereignty which exists. And that is the idea which I think our Constitution denies. Instead, it says there are three powers. There is the executive, there is the legislative, there is the executive, there is the judicial power. There is not power at large. And those three powers then are distributed to identified organs of government. That is the vision which I'd like to put before you. And of course, there are departures from that picture, and they are specifically identified. For instance, the Senate has the power and the responsibility to confirm appointments. The president can veto legislation. And you can look at those as exceptions from a grand structural design, or you can look at them as something else. And I will then give you the alternative vision, which I hope I will sketch with equal eloquence and conviction. That is the picture. Now, I am frank to say that the textual basis, as I said, for that picture is slim in this document. It is there, however, and of course, there is nothing in the document which says with what degree of seriousness the trifurcation of power is to be taken. But that's not a surprise. No document can authoritatively dictate the degree of seriousness with which that document itself shall be taken, can demand the degree of literalness with which its words be taken. And of course, the view that I'm putting forward is not a view which comes from any literal command of the Constitution, but emerges from thoughtful reflection on the structure of the document as a whole. And I do not blanch at the fact that that is what I recur to. Now, there is a contrary view of separation of powers, and that view is the one which I think really did obtain for quite a long time, with a few exceptions. It's a view which certainly was in the ascendance until 1976, in the first of the great Burger Court separation of powers decisions. And that is a view that separation of powers is a doctrine rather like federal or the 10th Amendment after Garcia. Well, that actually is not meant to be an entirely derisory or humorous remark, because the picture of federalism after Garcia is, yes, it's an important principle, but no, it is not a principle which is to be expressed through carefully worked out legal doctrines. It is a principle which is to be left to its fate in the political process. That is the vision of federalism which Garcia gave us. And it's not a silly vision, it's a serious point of view. And I put it to you that prior to Buckley, separation of powers was viewed in much that way, with the court having a role only to police the very outer margins for true extravagant divagations. Everything else was a matter of politics, which of course is where Garcia left the 10th Amendment. And on the basis of a reasoning which is really rather similar and analogous. What happened in Buckley, what happened in Chadha, what happened in Boucher was we began to see separation of powers put forward as a really thickly elaborated body of doctrine, ramified and exfoliated with all sorts of doctrines and sub-doctrines, rather like what we have in the First Amendment, you know, tripartite test with two prongs and all of that, or the Internal Revenue Code. And we should not make fun of that, because that is the symptom that the courts take an area seriously as law. Inevitably, when an area becomes serious law, it has to be fleshed out by complicated, elaborate legal doctrines. And that was what was happening to separation of powers until Morrison against Olson. Now, there were some contrary trends. I think Nixon against GSA, which was in that same time period, with its heavy emphasis about how all this is very pragmatic, was certainly a counter thrust. And more importantly still, I think, was CFTC against Shore, which first of all championed a balancing test, and balancing tests are trouble. Hermann Göring apparently used to say that when I hear the word culture, it makes me want to reach for my gun. Well, I have a similar view of balancing tests in areas which are supposed to be taken seriously as law. And there was another doctrine in Shore which I think was dangerous and bore fruit in Morrison, and that is the idea that it's okay to take bites out of the executive power, or indeed the judicial power. It's all right to do it so long as the biting agency does not aggrandize itself. Practically speaking, that means that Congress can mutilate the executive and the judiciary so long as it does not, as it did in Boucher, arrogate the mutilated part to itself. I'm not sure the metaphor works, but you see what I mean. That is, to my mind, if you'll forgive me, a not very sensible doctrine. It's not very sensible because anybody understands that Congress, when it diminishes the power of another branch of government, does not need to take that power onto itself to have increased its own power, because particularly when it diminishes the power of its arch rival, the executive, it is aggrandized. Everyone knows that. And the Shore decision, I think, was blind to that reality. Well, the question is, what does Morrison do to this? I am very troubled, very worried about Morrison, because I think Morrison, if we are to believe it, takes us back to the pre-Buckley stage where separation of powers is a little bit like the 10th Amendment after Garcia. I think it really was like Sherman's march to the sea. It left very little securely standing. And I think one might now want, I would like briefly to reflect with you why we had this history, which, if I'm right in my gloomy predictions about Morrison, lasted some dozen years. I think that what we saw in 1976 and what the court was responding to, perhaps, and rightly, was a combination of two factors. A tremendous increase in congressional ascendancy as a response to the Watergate and Vietnam era troubles, plus a tremendous deterioration in the coherence and responsibility which congressional power represented. And that was the result of a number of political forces which you're all familiar with, the decline of the seniority system, the rise of the PACs, the destruction of party coherence. So that what you had was a Congress which was at once much more assertive and much less coherent, representing a much less coherent expression of democratic will. There's a lovely story which I have heard about how Henry Friendly got on the Second Circuit. His name had been put up, and he was stalled in the Judiciary Committee. That happens sometimes, you know. Because a senator who had nothing against Henry Friendly had some pet project of his, and he was keeping this this particular nomination hostage to that project. And somebody went to Lyndon Johnson and complained of this. Lyndon Johnson picked up the phone, called the senator, got him on the line, did not bother to address him by name, said simply, "I understand you're sitting on somebody called Friendly. Get it done." The man was confirmed within 24 hours. Now, that is a worthy counterpart to the executive. That is an organ of government which is capable of coherent action. I think that what we, you know, whatever it might be, I think we have, you know, we have entered a different era. For a while, perhaps, the court understood that and saw that democratic coherence resided most securely in the executive. That's sort of pop political science. There is another alternative reading to what happened in Morrison, and let me put it before you briefly, and that is that the internal logic of the separation of powers cases, like Hegel's cunning of reason, required that these doctrines fall apart and that we be left, after all, with hardly any law in this subject. Perhaps that's so. That's not my view of it, but perhaps that's so. Well, I hope I've said enough to give you a picture of where we've been and perhaps what just happened to us, which is, I'm sure, not the picture that my friend and colleague Paul will offer, but at least it will start our discussions going. Thank you.
Well, it's old advice to take with a grain of salt the arguments of a lawyer who has just lost a case. And I think it's additional good advice to take it particularly with a grain of salt if he starts off by saying that he's not about to re-argue his case. I guess my view of the bottom line question is that the doctrine of separation of powers is not dead, although the version of it that was put forward, for instance, in Justice Scalia's dissenting opinion in Morrison and Olson, in a sense, that hasn't died either because it was never alive. That was never the law. It was never the Constitution. It was never the true meaning of the federal Constitution. Maybe of the Massachusetts Constitution. And I can't take quite seriously the topography that Charles Fried gives us here, having taught in this field for 30 years, that separation of powers was a kind of a mealy-mouthed, was unserious law. It wasn't even serious law until 1977 or 78. When it took on this wonderful life for a dozen years and then has now again bit the dust. That's a funny account. I mean, there is a lot of very complicated and serious doctrine by there, which has been winding its way in a whole lot of fields. In the field of the removal power, there's an incredibly complicated and elaborate doctrinal history. Beginning way back with Marbury and Madison. The question most recently revisited in Shore, the power of Congress to create adjudicating institutions, such as administrative adjudicators and legislative courts, has an immensely complex background. You have to be a little bit careful here also, because there's a lot of separation of powers law, an important separation of powers law that is hidden inside due process law. I think of the great case celebrated in the dialogue of Mr. Hart in the federal court's casebook, the great case celebrated in that dialogue, Wong Wing against the United States, that the Congress may not authorize the executive to impose infamous punishment on persons without court trial, a due process case, but basically grounded on separation of powers principles of the most fundamental importance. How can you think about separation of powers and not even mention the Steele seizure case? I think the way to start with this subject is, as Charles did, to go back and try to think about our Constitution and its language and its structure. How is the doctrine of separation of powers enacted in our Constitution? And as Mr. Fried, I think, acknowledged, there's very little in the text. There is very little specification of how powers are supposed to remain separate. It is the case that the Constitution implicitly recognizes that there will be three branches and allocates to each a central mission. But beyond that, the specification to be drawn about separateness in the Constitution is very little. The Constitution makes all kinds of very specific and detailed allocations of power in certain fields. The appointments issue, the presentment clauses. There are very many specific details as to which the Constitution is completely silent again, however. For instance, in how officials shall be removed rather than appointed. There are many decisions about allocation of powers in the Constitution that from a viewpoint of separation of powers seem contingent or even arbitrary. Why is it that the power to declare war belongs to Congress rather than the president? The English precedent, which would have made that, I think, a royal prerogative, could have pointed either way. First of all, furthermore, when the Constitution does specify, it so frequently specifies mixing rather than separation of powers. You all know the conventional examples of this: the president's veto power, the Senate's power to prevent appointments of the president's advisors. But there are more subtle and less conventional instances of mixing, which seem to be very characteristic of the document. It is, for instance, an oddity from the viewpoint of the pure or Scalia or Massachusetts version of separation of powers that the question of what structure the departments of government should have, and indeed what departments of government should exist, which after all is a surrogate for the question of what advisors the president should have, is left not to the president's decision, but to the power of the legislature to define. If the judicial power were to be completely independent, you would have thought the Constitution would have allowed the court system, in a way, to define its own jurisdiction and to have power over its own structure. But the court system is a complete servant of the legislature, both with respect to its jurisdiction and with respect to its structure of organization. So our actual Constitution, as it exists, is really almost the opposite of what might be called the heroic version of separation of powers, which is explicitly spelled out in the Massachusetts Constitution with language that does not appear in the federal Constitution. And when Madison tried in the new Bill of Rights to include a provision that would have ideologically sounded like the Massachusetts provision, that suggestion for inclusion in the Bill of Rights was defeated in the Senate and did not make it. Let's look for a second at the intellectual background within which all of this happened. If one looks at contemporary thought, I think it is one discovers that the silence of the Constitution on how the ideals of separation of powers are to be exemplified in an actual organization of government, that the silence of the Constitution on the issue of exemplification accurately reflects the state of opinion at the time. That is, if one looks at what separation of powers consisted of, what its content was in the intellectual thought of the late 18th century, we have very firm and important statements about the ideal of separation as an ideal and its importance to liberty. That is clear. But there existed at the time no consensus, no body of doctrine, no body of positive law that defined what system of government organization was necessary in order to satisfy the doctrine, or that described a system of government that would not satisfy the doctrine. In other words, there was no positive law or organizational content to the doctrine of separation of powers at the time. And that fact, that there was no consensus and no doctrine, explains two interesting phenomena. One, that the state constitutions which were undergoing creation and revision contemporaneously at the time, in fact, adopted hugely divergent versions of governmental organization, that there was a wide disarray of practice on how to create an organization that would satisfy separation of powers. The other interesting fact is that many of the most important specific decisions about separation of powers made in the Constitutional Convention were hugely disputed, and many of them were not resolved until the final moments of the convention. That is, they were totally up for grabs. There was no received body of opinion or consensus on how the president should be elected. And it was a very close shot that maybe the legislature would elect the president. And the appointments issue, too, was not settled until the last moment. Furthermore, even at the, if you will, ideological and rhetorical level, the claim that separation was important to liberty was in tension with an equally serious claim that had important roots in the political theory of the time. And this was the claim that no pure system could prevent tyranny, that what you needed was a mixed system of government that mixes all kinds of forms, that mixes the aristocratic, the monarchical, the democratic, in all kinds of complex ways. And that led, of course, to the emergence of the very dominant checks and balance theme in the structure of our Constitution. So my submission is that the Constitution does not enact an overarching practical system of governmental organization. The Constitution has some very specific textual arrangements. The background structure beyond the specific textual arrangements is highly uncertain and highly contingent. And that explains the fact that when you now look at the Supreme Court's jurisprudence built on this Constitution, that it has not eventuated in the heroic or what might be called puritanical a version of separation of powers, which is exemplified in the paragraph Mr. Fried read from the Massachusetts Constitution. What are the principal features of the Supreme Court topography as it has made law of separation of powers? It seems to me it consists of three parts. First of all, there are the cases where the court encounters specific textual command, and where the document, in its fair interpretation, demands that powers be allocated or divided or structured in a certain way, the court has been quite consistent in insisting that those commands be obeyed. And that seems to me to be the simple explanation of Buckley and Valeo, which ran squarely up against the specific commands of the Appointments Clause, and certainly explains the decision in Chadha. And in a sense, it is that tradition in the court's jurisprudence that Mr. Fried ran up against in Morrison and Olson when he failed to overcome the specific suggestion of the text that the judges too may properly be given the power to appoint officers of the United States as the text explicitly commands. I think the court throughout its history, and I guess here my song is not quite unlike Mr. Fried's, although I don't therefore say that this isn't serious. I think the court has come to the serious and doctrinal conclusion that where the text doesn't specify, there is no systematic or overarching strong form of separation of powers doctrine that the Constitution demands. That is to say, the court has resisted the claim that there are here three bundles of power, that they are separate, and that each branch has a monopoly over that bundle which is within its sphere. I read that system of jurisprudence, not as Mr. Fried does, as a failure to enforce norms that are there, but a refusal to invent a strong system of norms that are not there. And of course, we all know the famous, and I suppose most people in this audience would say infamous, examples of how the court has failed to find in the Constitution watertight systems of monopoly power and has allowed important sharings of power. The most important of these, by the way, is one that the celebrators of presidential power find non-problematic, although in many ways, from a separation of powers viewpoint, it's the most problematic. And that is the, by now, 150-year-old tremendous tradition allowing the legislative branch to delegate its legislative powers to the executive departments and agencies. My second major example is the 200-year tradition, which allows the Congress, notwithstanding, in this case, the fairly strong textual push of Article 3, to create adjudicating institutions which do not satisfy the requirements of Article 3. And really, the allowing of the whole administrative adjudication system. The third great example, of course, as we all know, is the court's willingness to allow Congress to create centers of policymaking power independent of the president. The rejection of the unitary executive. The intellectual roots of that also reach well back in the 19th century, de facto and in informal ways. There were many, many centers of executive power long before there were formal independent agencies. But of course, the formal ratification of the doctrine of Congress's power to create centers of policymaking power independent of the presidency came about with this century. So these are two parts of my topography. The textual commands are obeyed. In general, no overarching strong doctrine of three powers with a monopoly power of the three branches in each to be created. The third feature of the topography I see as occasional attempts, mostly by individual justices, usually in dissents, but occasionally surfacing in plurality opinions, and occasionally even in a majority opinion. I think Myers in the United States is perhaps the great example of this. To really go the other way and to find in the interstices of the Constitution a strong version of a unitary legislature, of a unitary executive, of a judicial power that is a monopoly of what is the judicial power. Here again, there are examples of this relating to each of the branches. The attempt in the 30s to recreate the doctrine of delegation was an attempt to find in the Constitution a strong version of separation of powers vis-a-vis the legislature. Justice Brennan's plurality opinion in the Marathon Oil case, pipeline case, with strong intellectual roots in previous attempts and in dicta by other justices, including Justice Sutherland and Williams in the United States, to create a strong version of a rule against Congress allowing anybody other than Article III courts to adjudicate cases. But the most serious and the most persistent effort to go the other way has been, of course, the attempt by some of the justices and the occasional acceptance by the court of a theory of a unitary presidency. And that issue has mostly fought itself out in the sphere of the removal of officers issue, Myers against United States. And it's the last burst, or most recent burst, I won't say last burst, of this attempt to create a strong general theory, which we see in Justice Scalia's dissent in Morrison and Ulf. The presidential or executive branch version of what I call this counter-revolutionary tradition is the most persistent, and the reason it's most persistent is because that one, unlike the anti-delegation or the Article III issue, has a persistent natural advocate in the Department of Justice. And it is the Department of Justice that over time, not just in conservative administrations, but in liberal, there were the liberal administrations too. The Humphreys case was a huge defeat for President Roosevelt, not for a conservative administration. But I see these as forays against the dominant tradition. And it seems to me that what history tells us is that at least so far, these counter forays have been hugely unsuccessful. They have popped up here and there. They have been unsuccessful. Why have they been unsuccessful? They've been unsuccessful because they are insufficiently rooted in the document, its structure, and its intellectual history. Justice Holmes says, you have said in the Myers case itself, you really have to spin a spider's web to make the case for the president's prerogative that the court did in that case. They have been unsuccessful as well, I think, because of some fundamental conceptual and epistemological problems in defining these powers and in creating a logical system for confining them. The great question is what all this effect this system of jurisprudence has had on liberty. That is the question that I want to propose for further debate is this. If this mine is a reasonable account of what the court has done, is it the case that this soft version, which insists on the text, but beyond that gives scope for flexible and elaborate mixings of powers, whether that has had an adverse effect on our liberties? Because that was the point of the rhetorical expressions of strict separation of powers that were voiced in the late 18th century. Okay.
We're on a particularly tight schedule this morning because of the president's speech after the lunch break, but we do have time for a very brief response by both speakers and then for some questions. Mr. Fried.
I thought Paul's remarks were in very good harmony with what I was saying. I think we have seen the history in rather similar ways, and that's reassuring. I don't think I don't celebrate it, I deplore it, but I think we describe a rather similar phenomena. I would like to just make one very brief observation and then leave time for discussion. Paul, I think, tells only half the story when he says that the separation of powers arguments, and particularly Madison's arguments, Hamilton's arguments in that respect, were addressed to individual liberty. He was also talking about, Madison particularly also spoke about an effective government, and he thought that the unitary executive was a necessary way to have an effective, I believe, muscular government, was what was said, and that it was necessary to overcome the natural disposition of Congress to reflect a kind of incoherent expression of factional views. And as to that, I would be interested to hear whether Paul or anyone else thinks that was an incorrect analysis. And only one picture comes to mind. I think of one very strong executive who I happen to admire in a nation which does not have a separation of powers. I think of Margaret Thatcher, who has done more for economic liberty and for some of the things that people in this room stand for than Ronald Reagan has been able to do. and starting from much further behind, I take it that the reason she was able to do it and the President of the United States has been less able to do it has been exactly because the ability of a chief executive to represent and to carry forward a clear electoral mandate is much harder to really instantiate in our blended, mixed, and confused system than in a system where the chief executive is somewhat less hampered. So that's just a one more pop political science observation. But I don't want to prevent the discussion, which I think we should have. Thank you.
I think I will overrule myself since the time is getting short and throw the discussion open for questions. If you would come to the microphone and specify the speaker you'd like to address your question to.
Well, this is really for either speaker. My name is Craig Bradley from Indiana University Law School. I was a little surprised that neither of you made what seemed to me a very salient observation about the Morrison case, which is that this case could largely be regarded as sui generis, whatever the discussion about separation of powers in the opinion. The court simply recognized that the executive branch cannot be trusted to investigate itself. Congress had enacted a rather pragmatic response to that problem, and the court, by an overwhelming majority, upheld it. But it doesn't have a great deal of implication for the future in terms of separation of powers doctrine.
No, I don't have a... I think I've said my bit, unless I've really got something I have to say. I'd really like to let people from the floor respond.
Okay, I guess it's a question without a direct answer. Brad?
Oh, I have a question for Professor Bator. You spoke of the... that there are textual mixtures in the Constitution, and then you say that there's no specific or strong overarching separation of powers doctrine as a residual background theory. But in deciding cases, if that's the case, are you saying that there's simply no law to apply when the court gets a case and that they simply defer to what the legislature has said? And if that's the case, then isn't it really a strong congressional theory? And if not, then if the president refuses to comply with a specific statute that he thinks violates separation of powers, what would the court do? Would they then defer to him as a no law to apply theory? Or, in other words, I don't think you can really take that position. I think you do have a theory, and it's that Congress can mix these powers.
Could you just do it here?
Well, that's an ingenious and important question. A partial answer to it is that if Congress enacts a statute and you cannot show that it violates some provision of the Constitution, then there is a strong presumption of constitutionality behind it. In this case, the notion that the congressional judgment stands unless you can show that it violates either the text or an important principle of the structure is the necessary and proper clause, which explicitly gives Congress power to make judgments about how to organize not only its own powers, but all of the powers of the government of the United States. And obviously contemplates that with respect to the many, many questions unspecified and unresolved in how to organize and allocate the functions of a complex government like the government of the United States, that the originating power to make the determination belongs in the legislature.
My name is Peter Davidson from Virginia Law School. I have a question for both the Solicitor General and Professor Bator. Given the heroic vision of the separation of powers in Myers, and given that that vision was somewhat trimmed back in Humphrey's executor, what then is left of Myers after Morrison, if anything?
I have I am not a visionary. I am not a seer. I can just barely see the past, and this is the future. I'm no good at it at all. I can't tell you. Let's hope for the best.
So you have a hope that there's something left of Myers and that it may be cited again in the Supreme Court opinion.
And we're all alive here, and some of us may be appointed to the Supreme Court, and who knows? I really have no, I have nothing to say about that. My fingers are crossed.
I don't know. No, I am reasonably satisfied with the doctrine as it stands, so I'm not looking for any new salvation.
Mr. Fried, you say that you and Professor Bator read the history the same way, and I'd like to renew part of his critique and have you respond to that, and that is that part of the received intellectual tradition was one of blending, that is, from Aristotle's Politics through Polybius through Cicero in the Commonwealth. And as I read the history and the debates between the Federalists and Anti-Federalists, one thing that they had very much in common was the goal to create a blended constitutional scheme. It seems to me if you admit that, then your only option is to say that blending took place on a level of the one, the few, the many, social orders rather than the executive, legislature, and judiciary. But it seems to me you have to acknowledge Professor Bator's point that it was blending rather than separation, or blending in addition to separation as part of the received intellectual tradition. I want to know how you handle that.
Well, I do think that talking about Polybius and Aristotle and so on, they were talking about social orders much more than they were talking about these three, the Montesquieuian separation of powers. But there's a simple answer. Also, that after all, the amount of blending that we get is specified by the particular instances provided for in the Constitution, and no more. That would be what I would suggest. For instance, the president's veto power. But, you know, that's a half-full, half-empty glass problem, and one can view it either way. I don't believe I've given an argument that has knocked your socks off. I understand that.
No, I guess just the follow-up would be that, do you read in Scalia's dissent, however brilliant it may be, a rather oversimplistic ignoring of the blending aspect of the constitutional plan?
No.
My socks have fallen down.
Also for the Solicitor General, it just struck me, although I tend to agree with your argument, that what you want to do in rearranging or setting up the separation of powers is essentially to give greater power to the judiciary to say what the Constitution is. And I know that's what Marbury versus Madison says, but then again, Congress and the President can read the Constitution too and arrange as well. So my question is, you're worried about Congress arrogating power to itself. What about the problem of the judiciary using its power as the referee to arrogate both the power of the executive?
Well, that's a very astute and serious interjection, I think. And it plays completely into my friend Paul's hands, because I think...
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Well, sure it does. And I hope I began by saying that Paul's picture of things is an alternative and very serious picture, and may indeed be the one which prevails, for all I know. And one of the strengths of the, if I may call it, the Garcia vision of separation of powers is that it does get the courts out of the refereeing business in a big way. There's no doubt. And that was, incidentally, one of the strengths which Justice Blackmun urged for
the Garcia decision that it began to be terribly difficult to say what was and was not a 10th Amendment violation, and let's get out of this business and leave it to politics. And I think Paul is saying a similar kind of thing. So that is a serious point you're making. But of course, we all know that the judiciary is the least dangerous branch.
Can I supplement the answer? It's important to remember when we say let's leave it to politics, we're talking about the 3% pathological fringe issues. That is to say that most of the terrain of separation of powers and most of its function in protecting liberty is uncontroverted, is uncontrovertible, and is based on settled understanding of who can do what. And amidst all the gloom and doom, don't forget that we've got a 95% non-pathological and beyond controversy settled understanding that the Congress, that the courts or the president cannot enact a tax law, or that if Congress chose to assess a tax and to sue for a deficiency, it would be laughed out of court. Or if the president purported to imprison for non-payment of tax without a statutory basis and without a court proceeding, it would not be permitted to do so. So there's a vast terrain here about which we can feel secure and which is the ordinary, non-pathological, settled understanding of the major mission of the three branches and how they get divided.
This is for Professor Bator. I consider myself a reasonably pragmatic person, even though I'm in academia. And so I hate to bring up a slippery slope argument, but do you see any dangers arising out of the special prosecutor precedent of having Congress set up special prosecutors for areas that do not affect directly the executive branch, but would intrude upon individuals' liberties? What would such limitations be? Could you respond to that?
Yes, I am not at all a fan of the current promiscuous use of special prosecutors. I think it is dangerous, and I think it is a bad thing, and I'm not going to start celebrating it here. Like many, many institutions of government, it can be overused, misused, exploited for political purposes. But to me, that's not the equivalent of a demonstration that it is unconstitutional. That seems to me to be a distinct question. And it is not the theory of the Constitution that anything that can create a dangerous precedent or that is subject to exploitation or misuse is for that reason unconstitutional.
Do you see any limitations to the government's power, and where would those limitations come from?
Yes, I mean, I think that there were due process issues and other possible issues lurking in the background of that case that maybe in another case can be exploited. I'm not enough of an expert on the details of the doctrine there to go further on that.
Thank you.
I think we can squeeze in one very quick question.
Thank you. I'm Dave Kahn from the Department of Commerce. The questioner two before me, very pleased, suggested that there was an arrogation of power by the judiciary rather than by the Congress. And I think that's just what happened, but in a slightly different form. It appears that the Congress, in passing the special prosecutor statute, arrogated the power, took it, and then gave it to the judiciary, and that the Supreme Court was loath to let it go once the D.C. Circuit had been given this power. What concerns me is not so much a blending, because the Appointments Clause does clearly permit the Congress to provide for appointment by the courts. But if there is to be any sort of blending, this indeed, one would think, would not be the appropriate place to blend, because rather than just arrogate itself the role of referee, the court now has the role to appoint people who, in a very few months, will be right before that same court. It would appear that there's a clear conflict of interest that the judges, when these cases get back up to the D.C. Circuit, either themselves or their colleagues, are going to be somewhat biased, perhaps, in favor of their appointee, as opposed to the other people who were before them as defendants. And I wonder if either one of you gentlemen might address this type of arrogation, which is a conflict of interest regardless of whether or not the courts can ever appoint anyone to an executive position.
It is a problem, but it's a problem at a level of detail which does not address the particular issue we have. One might say that this is the kind of problem you get when you start down this path, but I'm not sure I'm entitled to that cheap shot. So I'm not sure, so I won't take it.
I'd like to thank Mr. Fried and Mr. Bator for an outstanding discussion.